Zometeen de opening verrichten.
Het is wel extra spannend vandaag.
Ja, het is altijd al spannend.
Ja.
Dus ja, dan is het vandaag gauw extra spannend.
Ja, want het is nummer 20 schijnt ook.
Ook nog eens?
Och, de grootste nee. Ooit.
Jongen, jongen, de grootste ooit.
Ja, mogelijk hè.
Jongen, jongen. Ja.
De grootste ooit.
Dat is maar goed dat dit geen pornofilm is.
Hoe weet je dat zo zeker? Er gebeuren gekke dingen hier hoor.
Oké, wat jij wil.
Je moet ook eventjes zoeken.
Maar heb jij nog plannen, Maarten?
Altijd, maar met de aanzien van dit festival niet.
Nee?
Nee.
Nee, dat is, ik heb de indruk dat de meeste mensen die zeggen van nou, ik laat me verrassen.
Ja, dat sowieso. Iedere dag.
Ja.
Ja.
Ja, daar heb je geen vurige tongen voor nodig.
Nee, nee. Nee hoor. Maar ik vind het nu al gezellig.
Ja, ook, ja.
Het is nog niet eens begonnen. Ja. Dus wat dat betreft nou, kan het niet meer stuk.
Een soort pre-ding, maar dat was heel serieus. Van die Jan van Akel.
Oh, heel serieus.
Maar het ging over Turkije en Rusland. Het was wel serieuze shit.
Oh, over zijn boek, over zijn boek.
Ja.
Leuk boek hoor,
trouwens.
Ja, reet spannend. Het Xoanon.
Xoanon?
Ja.
Wat is dat nou weer?
Dat is een... een houten afgodsbeeld.
Oh.
Of zoiets. Ja.
Een vergankelijk afgodsbeeld.
Ja. En
we worden nu aan de kat gedirigeerd.
We worden aan de kat gedirigeerd.
Ja, hoe zijn de verwachtingen vandaag?
Nou, je zou zeggen hoog gespannen. Hè? De 30ste keer zo ongeveer.
Zonder wedstrijdspanning.
20ste vurige tongen trofee uitreiking. Maar in alle eerlijkheid, die spanning valt wel mee.
Ja, toch.
Maar hoog is het wel.
De zon doet zoveel goed werk vandaag.
Zo.
Wauw.
Dus een beetje een leuke spanning is te snijden. Hè? Dan kan je hem namelijk aan kleine stukjes snijden. Zodat iedereen een stukje spanning mee kan krijgen.
Ja, ze zullen
een vers afgesneden stukje spanning.
Een blokje spanning.
Nou, zit het, de luisteraar, de poëzie spuit hier uit de grond.
Ja, dat mag ook wel.
Lijkt wel een kosmisch lek.
Ja. Echt gratis, hè? Improvisatie.
Gratis lek.
Een gratis kosmisch lek. Pro Deo. Oh jezus, ik zoek nu naar allerlei mensen in de crowd waarvan ik weet dat ze er nooit meer zullen staan, die er altijd stonden. Dat is wel een beetje raar.
Ja.
Maar it's well the way of the world.
Zo is het. En uit hun as.
Precies.
Er is zoveel moois verrijzen.
Ja, het is een beetje zo van dat je allerlei innerlijke bibliotheken verwoest ziet gaan.
Ja.
In brand en rook opgaan. Maar bij het vuur en het licht schijnsel ervan dat je daar bij nieuwe meesterwerken schrijft.
Ik ben moeder Aardig. Ik ben moeder Aardig. Al eeuwen zijn mensen mijn hemelse lijf op het lichaam geschreven. Mijn bergen zijn borsten die grondwater geven, rivieren doen leven. Ook mijn wolken zijn barsten en mijn melk is de regen. Mijn kraters zijn navels, want ik ben een buik, een wereldbolle buik en ik kan buik spreken. Ja, als de wind de kop opsteken, gaan liggen of met mijn oog in de orkaan met stilte toestaan. Ik geef telkens donder en bliksem inbegrepen, losgezongen, wanneer ik mijn mond een vulkaan maak met vurige tongen. Daarom dacht ik, hoe kan ik al dit ruige oord op andere wijze spreken? En met mijn klankschaal als spreekbuis in een verstaanbare taal een teken van leven geven. Nou, dat doe ik zo. Het toeval bepaalt mijn lot. Een dame draaide van mijn aarde en aardewerken pot. Vrouwen potten, mannen poten. En zo werd mijn aarde pot door die vrouw vol aarde gestort, ja. Waarna een man met een poolstok er een zaadje in stootte. En toen kwam er als plot, en dat was echt top, een kind die mijn aardepot voorzag van een pratende kop, die gelukkig ook jullie moedertaal spreekt. Dus, uit de grond van mijn hart, welkom in mijn groene paleis. Jullie zijn het waardig. neer te strijken op de schoot van moeder. Ik ben als matrijs voor vruchtbaarheid in de oertijd als oermoeder vereerd. En met mijn ronde vormen als uitschodin gepersonificeerd. Modder, meer, moeder, moer, mata, madere, meter, mater, matrone, materie, materiaal, ma beker. Matrix, voor alles dat zich openbaarde uit baarmoeder aarde, de vochtige. Als moeder aller stenen, aller planten, aller dieren, wordt mijn naam gedragen door mensen en rivieren. Ik word ook met voeten getreden, ondersteboven vastgezogen. Loop je over me heen, ik ben een magneet en lig in jouw ogen aan je voeten nederig te wezen. Als een blok aan je been. Zoals al gesteld, ik ga hier niet klagen over al het geweld vanwege mijn... Zoals al gesteld, ik ga je niet klagen over al het geweld vanwege mijn metaal waar mijn wapens van smelt. En dat 100.000 megahertz weltschmerz is gemeld. Nee, vandaag geen klaagzang over dat ik ontaard ben verklaard door een mensenplaag. Of dat het diertje mens zijn biotoop onleefbaar maakt. Voor een goudaderlating. Die zijn geldgod. Mensen werken op mijn lachspieren. Ik word ondermijnd, uitgezogen met troep volgespoten, bestolen, bezoedeld, geplunderd, verwoest, geplukt, verkaveld, opgeblazen, platgetrapt, kalgeslagen en afgegraven. Met al hun gewriemel en gekriemel en gekietel vanwege dat gegraaf. Pis ik soms in mijn broek echt hard van het lachen. Wel een hele tsunami vol. En geef ik kolen en olie voor de steden die stinken. En dan stik ik pas echt van het lachen. Is het lachen geblazen hoor. Echt waar, we hebben zo'n lol. En dan gaan mijn orkanen weer razen. Ja. Af en ja, knikker, schier ik het uit. En dan lig ik te schudden buiken. Als er weer een chronische gasbel verdwijnt onder druk van de tektonische platen. Als door mijn gebulder mijn magneetje verschuift, dan weet jij niet waar je blijft. Ja, schaterend laat ik mijn bewoners hier en daar wegvagen. Glierend en proestend, zodat zeeën buiten hun oevers treden. Ik laat ijskoud lachend als een sneeuwbal een ijstijd aanbreken, of wederom een vuurzee voor mij spreken. Ja, gaat de kruik wel te water tot ze barst van het lachen. Soms lach ik ze allemaal één keer kapot. We zouden het aardig houden, dus van persoon tot persoon. Ik ben eigenlijk net als jij heel gewoon. Alleen jullie mensen lijden aan een moeder-aarde-syndroom. Ikzelf heb moeder, nog vader, kind, nog kraai en niemand nodig, nee. En dop op mijn eigen wijze, in mijn eigen tempo, mijn eigen bonen. Ze noemen mij vaak Gaia. Ken je mijn pseudoniem? Ik heet Geo voor geografie en geopolitiek. Geo die Sint Georgie in het leven riep. Om de draak te steken met de jungle die ik schiet. Ik wil ook geen Geo en Gaia zijn. Als heilige hermafrodiet. Hoe aan het ontgoden en ontginnen van de planeten te beginnen? Nou, door op te houden met het aanbidden. Vader, zon, moeder, maan. Infantiele projecties die overgaan. Ook al geeft de maan menstruatie aan. Ik doe aan zelfbevruchting. Wel makkelijker. En ook al heet ik moeder. Ik wil genderneutraal bestaan. Net als jullie ben ik deel van een kosmische vibration. Vijf elementen breng ik samen. Daaraan ontleen ik mijn gratie. Het kosmisch octaaf doorkneedt mijn hemelslichaam met aarde, eten, vuur en water. Dankzij het kosmisch octaaf dien ik van repliek. Met de mondiale muziek, de voor jullie onaanhoorbare dynamiek. Een storm die huilt, een ketel die fluit, gefladder, gesis, geknars en gesnuit. In een wereld als klankschaal bepaalt het kosmisch octaal de klankkleur van de straat. Verbaal, kabaal en wild geraas. De tonen van donenkunstenaars. Een oorverdovende golf die breekt in de branding. Pure magie waarop je kunt reflecteren. Een symfonie of een lied componeren, improviseren. Dat doen ook de planeten, zoals je ziet. Ik zeg keer op keer. Ik verkeer in een hogere sfeer. Ben wellicht in de atmosfeer en wil geen godinnenverering meer. En geen godinnenverering meer. Natuurlijk, vrouw Freya en moeder natuur en moedertje zon bij dageraad mogen voor mijn part allemaal bestaan. Maar net als moedertje zon aan de horizon, als de zon ondergaat, je kent het, de rest klinkt al minder aangenaam. Op Mars, om daar een oorlogsgod te eren, of om op venerische heuvels van Venus te recreëren. Planeten zijn net als mensen. Planeten hebben vriendjes en houden van. Planeten zijn net als mensen. Planeten hebben vriendjes en houden van spelen. Lalalala. Ik speel vaak met Venus en met Mars, Pluto, Jupiter en de zon. Ook zij zijn geen goden. Nog antropomorf. Ja, ik ben slechts moeder aarde. De donkere aarde, moeder alles. Moeder van al één. Helemaal één. Deel van het heel al. Ik heb een begin en een eind. Net als de lente die hier jaarlijks verrijst uit de voedingsbodem. Voor het paradijs. Ave, Eva, waar blijft de tijd? Met het malle diertje mens wil ik wel een potje spelen. Ja, dankzij het kind dat mij een gezicht heeft gegeven, kan ik je het symbioseren, de symbiose aanbevelen. Dus laat me met rust, komt alle tot mij om jezelf te vinden en inzicht te krijgen. Ook ik ben op zoek naar mijn eigen.
Thank you.
zeker. Ja. Af en toe dan, ja, maar...
Ja, welkom op vurige tongen. Ja, het Pinksterweekend waarin de Heilige Geest gaat neerdalen. We zien Hans Plomp, we zien Aya en we zien zoveel mooie mensen. En we beginnen even met een leuk gedichtje van mijn grote vriend Paulus. Laat het even openen met een goed gejoel. Dit is vurige tongen. Ruigoord 2024. Mogen de Heilige Geest in ons allen neerdalen.
Was is das? Okay.
When I was a boy, das wäre wunderschön. Dann könnte ich jeden Tag in langen Hosen gehen. Und käme ich abends spät nach Hause, macht mir keinen schwarzen Kram. Das wäre halb so schwer, wenn ich ein Junge wäre. Nur wenn Gino, Gino, Gino mich küsst. Und wenn Gino, Gino, Lüb mir isst. Ich will Gino, Gino, Gino mir isst. Wenn ich ein Junge wär, nur wenn Gino, Gino, Gino mich küsst. Und wenn Gino, Gino lieb mir ist. Wenn Gino, Gino, Gino mir ein. Eine Pico, Picolina, Carina, Pampina, Cecilia, Signorina. So, was so ein junger Boy aus lauter Liebe tut. I would go to Transylvania. I would go to Transylvania. Ich hab genug Verkehr, wenn ich ein Junge wär.
I wanted to turn into a butterfly, but I couldn't trust you enough.
Today I want to talk about the Chechens, both in and out of Ukraine. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti. And welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company, Conductor. So this episode, which might turn out to be a rather short one, was triggered by a spat between everyone's favourite monsters, Yevgeny Prigozhin of Wagner and Ramzan Kadyrov of Chechnya. And what happened was that on the 31st of May, Prigozhin, in response to certain suggestions, made his view known that he didn't think that the Chechen Akhmat Battalion Special Forces Unit could hold all of the contested Donbass region. I mean, in fairness, he said that it could hold some locations, but not the whole of the Donbass. Now, if I may use a phrase that I never imagined I would ever say, I agree with Yevgeny Prigozhin. The Akhmat Battalion, I'll talk a little bit more about its strength later, but even if we are erring on the side of generosity, there are about 3,000 troops we're talking about. Now, the Donbass, the whole of the Donbass region, which is what he's talking about, is 9,000 square miles. Now, all of Chechnya comprises 6,700 square miles, and it is actually controlled by a much, much larger force of Kadyrovtsi, various security forces loyal to Kadyrov, and is not the subject of a current high-intensity war. So this would seem to be a fairly reasonable statement from this usually most unreasonable of men. But then again, he's now butting heads with another particular flavour of unreasonableness. Kadyrov was reportedly furious, and, well, this obviously meant that there was room for his various mouthpieces and minions. Enter, first of all, Adam Delimkhanov. Now, he's the senator. He represents Chechnya to the Federation Council. Also, the so-called man with the golden gun, which sounds a lot more exciting than it really is. He has a gold-plated Makarov pistol that he was presented. But also, just to give a sense of the kind of chap he is, he's convincingly or plausibly accused of the murder of one of a member of a rival family. This was Sulim Yamadayev in the United Arab Emirates in 2009. And to the best of my knowledge, is still the subject of an Interpol arrest warrant. And this is a chap who, back in 2022, shared a video on Instagram, which seems to be one of the social media outlets of choice for the Chechens, threatening a particular human rights lawyer and his family, classily enough, saying, "We will come after you until we cut off your heads and kill you." And I liked the precision that was present in actually pointing out that they'll also be killing them as well as cutting off their heads. Anyway, Adam Delimkhanov rather sort of furiously turned on Prigozhin with, again, a public social media post in which he said, "You've become a blogger who screams and shouts at the whole world," which, again, in fairness, is not entirely untrue. "Stop shouting, yelling and screaming. You don't know about our capabilities or goals." Well, that told him. But then we had the Speaker of the Chechen Parliament, one Magomed Daoudov, on whom Kadyrov notoriously placed the sobriquet Lord, because apparently the first time he met Kadyrov, who we should remember, after all, famously or infamously, the first time he met Putin, was just simply wearing a tracksuit. But anyway, when Lord turns up in his... When Daoudov turns up in a black and white suit, looking very elegant, Kadyrov said that he looks like an English lord, and hence the name stuck. Now, he is very much Ramzan's right-hand man, and that hand is very often clenched in a fist. And certainly in this case, he was, as usual, not in conciliatory mood, warning Prigozhin that his open discussion of the problems facing the military were not helpful, and adding, "For such words during the Second World War, you would have been immediately put up against a wall," and presumably by implication shot. Well, Prigozhin had his own defenders. We had particularly Dmitry Utkin, the man who was essentially the first operational commander of Wagner and who gave it its code name. I always loved the sort of rather coy explanation that he did so because Dmitry Utkin's own code word was Wagner because of his appreciation of the Nazi aesthetic. Anyway, Utkin struck back, basically, particularly sort of expressing fury at the discourteous tone with which Prigozhin was being treated. Because after all, as we know, Prigozhin himself is very, very hot on correct etiquette. But then we had Prigozhin himself saying that he had, you know, basically sorted things out. He, in his own words, I got a call from Ramzan. We talked and agreed that we put a lid on the whole story. The conflict is settled. It's quite interesting. He makes the point that he got a call from Kadyrov. He's making the point that Kadyrov was the one who really wanted to end it. I mean, that may or may not be true, but there is still a certain degree of that kind of rather crass, quote-unquote, alpha male jostling there. Anyway, so what can we actually learn from this particularly unedifying exchange? Well, first of all, I think it really does emphasise the degree to which Prigozhin and Kadyrov are not real allies, despite the fact that, first of all, sort of some observers, particularly observers outside Russia, made a big play of this. Instead, it's just simply that they often have congruent interests, and in some ways they both have a rather outspoken populist style. Now, for example, I mean, back in September of 2022, Kadyrov and Prigozhin were both attacking Shoigu, the defense ministry, and chief of the general staff, Kadyrov. And this is what seems to have generated a lot of the loose talk about an alliance. But as I said, the interesting thing was Prigozhin was making an attack and Kadyrov was really looking to piggyback on it. There was never any sense of any kind of real reciprocity there. Now, since then, I mean, the Institute for the Study of War has suggested that this particular spat was something that the Kremlin orchestrated as part of a plot to undermine Prigozhin. But honestly, I don't buy that. Firstly, because in fact, it ends up with Prigozhin looking stronger and Kadyrov looking weaker because of the way it seems to be that Kadyrov was the one who was seeking peace. Secondly, look, I mean, there is just no evidence to back that up, and certainly no evidence that the Kremlin uses Kadyrov in that kind of way. This, for me, is just a case of two conflict entrepreneurs butting heads. Kadyrov, in many ways, had been quite jealous, it's clear that, of Prigozhin's, not just his successes on the battlefield, but his capacity to leverage that into this persona as the thuggish yet tough, no-nonsense to the point of view of absolute ruthlessness, man of action on the battlefield. Kadyrov every now and then had claimed that he's been there in Ukraine and such like, but frankly, we have no real evidence of that and it's hard to take seriously. So I think from Kadyrov's point of view, you know, he was basically angry at this. He doesn't want to put, and I'll talk about this in a moment, much of his own skin in the game. But on the other hand, when he spots something that he thinks of as a slight on his forces in Ukraine, and by extension him, then he will push back. Unfortunately, in Prigozhin, he was facing a rather different type of antagonist. So let's not assume that just because there are times when figures like Prigozhin and Kadyrov have the same target, that they are in any ways of the same camp. Quite the opposite. In many ways, they are competing with each other. They are competing with each other for the role of A, the kind of most outspoken guardian, defender, advocate of Russian national power, and also as the scarecrow, the person who is willing to articulate the most preposterously extreme positions. I mean, let's not forget, we've had Prigozhin suggesting that really Russia needs to become like North Korea to win, although that may have been tongue-in-cheek. And certainly not tongue-in-cheek, we've had in February, as I recall, Kadyrov suggesting that really Russia ought also to invade Poland and denazify that. You know, these are not actual serious policy positions. But in part, they are precisely to position themselves, the individuals in question, as being both irreproachable in their advocacy of state interests, but also impossible to outflank. So in this respect, actually, given that they are in their own ways occupying a similar niche, certainly when it comes to Kremlin politics, no wonder we can expect them to compete. Second broad point is about what's actually going on in the conflict, in the war in Ukraine, when it comes to the Chechens? Now, it's often said, again, in the less expert media, that Kadyrov, like Prigozhin, is a key figure in the war effort. But I really doubt that. And to an extent, I think this is actually the result of the fact that Kadyrov, for all his simplicity in other matters, is actually quite assiduous and effective in his positioning of himself and of Chechnya through social media and other forms of narrative. What have we actually got that the Chechens have deployed into Ukraine? There are, of course, elements of the so-called Kadyrovtsi, who are now rolled within Rosgvardia, the Russian National Guard, even though, and I'll talk about this in a minute, their chain of command essentially leads through Grozny rather than anywhere else. The main element is the so-called Akhmat Special Forces Battalion, which is, I mean, it's named after Akhmat Kadyrov, Ramzan's deceased father. And look, even if we accept that it's a reinforced battalion, it's unlikely to have much more than 1,000 soldiers. There's also the so-called Sevier Akhmat, North Akhmat Special Purpose Regiment. But again, although it's a regiment, first of all, there's no evidence that it's anywhere near full regimental strength. And secondly, perhaps more to the point, I have yet to see any kind of serious evidence to suggest that the entire regiment has been deployed to Ukraine. We've had stuff coming out of Chechnya, which shows, you know, the regiment being mustered and Kadyrov waving them away onto Ukraine. But in terms of actual evidence that they are in theatre, that's distinctly uncertain. So look, all told, I mean, I would reckon that we're probably talking about maybe 3,000 Chechen troops in Ukraine, which is, I don't know, maybe a brigade strength. Certainly, it is only a tiny fraction of the overall Russian forces there, or even, frankly, not a particularly big fraction of the Rosgvardia troops there. But nonetheless, we get a lot of sound and fury on social media about their activities. But what have they really been doing? Well, look, it's clear that they definitely played a role in the very, very early stages of the invasion, where they were sent into or towards Kyiv with an idea of essentially being used to quite possibly decapitate the Ukrainian leadership. I'm not entirely sure if I mean that literally or not. And also beyond that, as a terror slash mopping up force. The idea being, after all, that, you know, as we all knew, Ukraine was going to fall quickly and neatly into the Russian hands. Nonetheless, there would presumably still be pockets of resistance. And the thing about the Chechens is not just that they can be unleashed against the civilian population, but that precisely they have a terrifying reputation, which presumably, and I'm guessing here, the hope was that that would act as a deterrent. Of course, the battle did not exactly go the way Putin had planned. Quite the opposite. It turned into a nasty conflict against an exceedingly determined enemy. And at a very early stage, the Chechens, who are coming in from the north as part of that initial invasion sort of strike towards Kyiv, suffered very heavy losses near to a town called Hostomel. At that point, Kadyrov seems to have basically pulled them back from the front line. And again, I would stress, they do what Kadyrov tells them, not what their notional commanders do. Anyway, from that point on, Kadyrov was exceedingly solicitous of his men. After all, remember that the Kadyrovsi are absolutely crucial to his maintenance of power within Chechnya. Chechnya is a thuggish and brutal police state with an overlay of Sharia law and a certain degree of patronal politics as a fraction of the amount of money that is pouring into the hands of Kadyrov and his cronies does head out into other hands. But he needs these Kadyrovtsi. They are really the fundamental building block of his system and his survival, and also they are part of his dowry to Moscow. His capacity to, from time to time, send these guys. They, for example, were deployed, or some of them, were deployed to Syria in the guise of military police. I mean, the idea was that, oh, no, these are just Chechen military police who will be able to, therefore, talk to the Syrians in their own language, understand their culture, be co-religionists and the like. Well, there are no all Chechen military police units. These were just Kadyrovtsi who had exchanged their Rosgvardia uniforms for military police ones. That's all. But again, that was part of the deal that Kadyrov had with Moscow. So he needs these guys. He doesn't want to waste them. He's not that interested in putting them into the real meat grinders. For example, I mean, there were claims that they played a particularly important role in Mariupol, which was absolutely a meat grinder. But the point is that when one looks at how they're being appraised by Russian military sources and by a certain number of the more candid military correspondents, the Voyenkori, on social media, it is clear that there is a strong sense of exasperation, a sense that basically these guys are much, much more interested in filming video of themselves doing dramatic things to be put on social media than they are in actual fighting. Back in October, for example, Ramzan Kadyrov said that in some recent engagements they had suffered 23 dead and 58 wounded. Which is interesting because the sad truth of the matter is that from the point of view of casualties to Russian units facing proper full-on warfare with the Ukrainians, that's not really the kind of figures that you bother announcing. They're really not that great. But clearly from Kadyrov's point of view, it was a big deal. And that suggests that the overall Russian perspective, that the Chechens are either killers, murderers, I would say, in some ways, in other words, being deployed against targets that can't fight back, or poseurs, rather than actually fighters, definitely still holds true. What's the third point that really one can learn from this overall kerfuffle? Well, I think it is precisely that Chechnya and Kadyrov are still pretty much autonomous within the Russian system. Even as we see attempts to turn this slightly sort of postmodern mix of authoritarianism with a bit of popular participation into a good old-fashioned authoritarianism, well, Chechnya still remains a special case. We can see that certainly in the chain of command in Ukraine. I mean, as I've indicated, technically speaking, the Kadyrovtsi that are in Ukraine are part of Rosgvardia, the National Guard. Now, that already throws a particular complexity in, because although Rosgvardia forces in the war are meant to be subordinated to the overall Joint Forces Commander, which is Chief of the General Staff, General Gerasimov, at the moment, in practice it has become clear that it's one thing when relatively straightforward orders come down the line, but where there are major ones, or where, maybe I'm being over-cynical here, but the local Rosgvardia commanders really don't like those orders and are hoping that they'll be countermanded, they clearly do check in with General Zolotov, their overall commander in Moscow, and just basically get some kind of a sign-off. So already the Rosgvardia are a kind of semi-detached element of the Russian forces. And within the Rosgvardia, the Chechens clearly have their own chain of command going back to Grozny. So in other words, if Gerasimov wants them to do anything, whether or not he can do so depends entirely on whether or not Kadyrov is happy for that. And in the main, Kadyrov seems perfectly willing to say no if it would put his little babies in harm's way. So that's the situation on the ground, and that is really just a reflection of what's happening at home. And again, this is a wider point, actually. If you'll excuse me, I just want to dwell on for a moment. The mess that is the Russian chain of command in Ukraine is a direct reflection and result of the political system itself. Putin created this political system, this adhocracy, based precisely on divide and rule, on individuals and institutions with overlapping and competing remits, on encouraging rivalries rather than creating sensible structures. And that works very, very well if you're just simply trying to use divide and rule to keep an opportunistic elite squabbling amongst themselves so that you remain the central pivotal figure. Export that to the battlefield, though, and it is proving to be pretty catastrophic. So in this respect, we shouldn't be surprised that the Chechens are essentially an autonomous and self-interested force on the battlefield, because they are an autonomous and self-interested force within the entire Putin system. Remember, the deal that was struck to, in effect, end the Second Chechen War, which was done to a large extent by Chechenizing it, by enlisting Chechens in support of the federal cause, Chechens who could basically take on the Chechen rebels on an even footing, was precisely to give the Kadyrov, might become the Kadyrov dynasty, now that Kadyrov's teenage son has been formally presented in front of the cameras to Putin, who can tell. But anyway, the point is the Kadyrovs were granted not just essentially carte blanche as to what they did within their republic, but also, if I can continue to mix my metaphors, a blank check. 80 to 90% of Chechnya's budget, Chechnya's Republican budget, actually is provided from the federal budget. So in other words, it is a gift from Moscow. What's more, something like 40% of the entire Chechen GDP is made up for by so-called the budget sector, the budgetniki, people who are essentially civil servants in one form or another. They could be soldiers, they could be teachers, whatever. and who are therefore paid out of the federal budget. And over one third of all the economically active population of Chechnya is employed directly or indirectly by the government that is in turn almost entirely bankrolled by Moscow, and yet without any real control from Moscow. If one looks at the usual control mechanisms, whereby the centre keeps regions in check, it is, first of all, control over the budget. But the point is, well, as I'll come to, every time the Russians even hint at that, Kadyrov calls their bluff. Or else it's through the use of various control mechanisms, apparatuses like the Federal Security Service, the FSB, the Investigatory Committee, the police, and such like. Well, in Chechnya, all of those have essentially been tamed and or Chechenified. Although that need not mean Chechenified in terms of nationality. For example, since 2020, the head of the Chechen Federal Security Service, FSB, has been Igor Kochnev, who was previously the FSB chief in the Siberian region of Tumen. Well, that sounds like he's an outsider, someone who could actually be relied on to keep an eye on what's going on in Chechnya for Moscow's purposes. Not necessarily. But let's have a break. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. Like any despot, Kadyrov has wanted to squeeze out any kind of constraints, checks and balances to his rule. The local interior ministry is technically a part of the All-Russian Federation ministry, but in practice everyone knows that the orders do not come from Moscow. Likewise, the Kadyrovtsi are not just within the Rosgvardia, they represent all of the Rosgvardia within Chechnya, so there's no separate force of leg breakers at Moscow's control. Kadyrov made a point of squeezing out military intelligence, the GRU, which after all had tried for as long as possible to maintain a sort of counterweight, particularly through the aforementioned Yamadayevs. And Kadyrov methodically had their key figures forced into exile, killed, or in most cases, both. Even the Investigatory Committee has been really, I would say again, house-trained,